Oyez, oyez, oyez. All persons having business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this Honorable Court. Be seated, please. Case number 10-5355, David M. Roeder et al. Appellants versus Islamic Republic of Iran et al. Mr. Terwilliger for appellants, Mr. Yellen for appellees.
Mr. Terwilliger.
Good morning, Judge Garland. May it please the court, George Terwilliger for Colonel Roeder et al. It's my honor to be here this morning to represent before the court these fine Americans who were held hostage for 444 days while in the service of their country. Their legal interest in obtaining justice against Iran has now been held hostage for 30 years by the terms of an agreement that was reached while their captors had a gun to their heads. Congress now, however, has provided the means by which they are freed of that legal bondage, and the application of existing law by this court is all that's required to give them their day in court. The decisional question in this case is simple and narrow. Can the text of Section 1083C3 be read to require that a prior case be pending at the time the 2008 National Defense Authorization Act was enacted in order to qualify as a related action under what is now 28 U.S.C. 1605A? All that prevents these plaintiffs from litigating a cause of action against Iran for their captivity is the notion that the statutory term, quote, has been timely commenced, could reasonably and plausibly mean more than it says by requiring, in addition to having been timely commenced, that the prior action was pending when the NDAA was enacted.
Even if we agreed with your reading of that, that doesn't answer the question, does it? I mean, it has to be clear that the Algiers Accords were abrogated. And do you get that type of clarity simply by your even reasonable construction of a complex statutory scheme?
I think so, Judge Griffith, simply because of the operation of a couple of now well-established doctrines. I don't think the court needs to look to any new law in order to make this decision. Looking at the cases as have been gathered in Fund for Animals in the Roeder 1 decision, in this case, the clear statement that's required here can be of two characters. One, it can either be an express statement by the Congress to the effect of the Algiers Accords are hereby abrogated, or a clear statement would constitute a later in time statute which is in complete repugnancy to the bar of the Algiers Accords. The only thing the government has raised here, and which the district court pointed to, but I would submit didn't even adopt or at least articulate as a determination of ambiguity, is whether this phrase has been timely commenced can mean or read into that section C3 some pending case requirement. If that's not there, if that's not a reasonable interpretation of C3, then these plaintiffs have a cause of action under the new statute, and that is a clear statement in abrogation of the bar to that claim under the Accords. In addition to that, in this case, there is a not meaningless specific reference in the jurisdictional section of the statute, which goes to also constitutes a clear statement by the admonition that a court shall hear a claim under this section. While that's the same language that was present in the Roeder 1 decision by this court, the context of that statement is entirely different than it was before, because there's now a brand new exception to sovereign immunity, which includes Iran. There is a new cause of action established, which was not present at the time of Roeder 1, was under 1605A7. And the two relate, obviously, by reference in the statute to claims under this section. The cause of action section refers back to the jurisdictional section. Respectfully, and I think maybe this goes to further answer to your question, Your Honor. The issue is not what Congress could have said here to abrogate the accords. It's not what it could have written. The issue here is centered on the text that it did pass and that, in fact, the President signed. I would respectfully submit that in order to find ambiguity in the plain language of the statute, it has to admit of something that is inherently unclear. The text says nothing about a pending related case requirement, and neither the government nor the district court here have offered a basis, which I submit, that upon which this court can conclude that there is some other plausible and reasonable interpretation of that language that would include a pending requirement.
Is it ambiguous whether Congress intended to abrogate the Algiers Accord?
Not if the statute is not ambiguous, Judge Randolph, because...
But I don't understand the general idea that, well, we have to see if the statute's ambiguous. Whenever, there has to be a context to that, doesn't there? Don't you have to ask a question? You know, with respect to subject X, is the statute clear or is it not clear? And so just say, is this an ambiguous statute? Gives me no context.
I agree with that. And the government has conceded below and in their briefs here that all the elements of these plaintiffs having a cause of action under the new 1605A are met, save for this related case provision.
But that was true the first time around.
No, it wasn't by this court's determination as well.
Let me put it this way. There was no federal cause of action, we finally determined. But whether they had a cause of action or didn't have a cause of action did not affect the outcome of the case. So now you come back and you say, well, now they've got a federal cause of action. Well, but that didn't play a role in the last decision.
Well, I think, Judge Randolph, what that analysis indicates is that the analysis the court needs to go through here is entirely different than in the analysis it went through in Rader 1. The analysis that's at issue here is when you look at this statute in toto, do these plaintiffs unambiguously have a cause of action against Iran? If this statute unambiguously gives them a cause of action, then the comparison is to the bar to that the pursuit of that claim that was in the Algiers Accords. Those two are in complete repugnance. And the only thing that's been raised in this case that suggests otherwise is this notion that there's a pending case requirement in the related case provision. And unless there is an ambiguity on the face of the statute in C3, then the plaintiffs prevail here.
What do you say to the government's argument, or to the government's question, which is, why does the section refer to A2AI rather than also to A2B? Obviously, if it referred to A2B, you'd be home free. That would be the end of it, right? Because that would be a direct reference.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. Are you talking about the reference to the prior case?
Yeah. In the private right of action section, it says, a foreign state that is or was a state sponsor of terrorism as described in subsection A2AI.
Right.
If it had said A2AI or A2B, you would be home free because B is you.
Right, but we're not.
Without any doubt.
Yes. We're not depending on that statement alone as establishing that there is a cause of action here. In fact, I think it's more an accurate statement of our position taken below and taken here is that even without that statement, we have a cause of action under this statute. And that
right, but arises through the operation of A2AI and then going back over to 1083, right?
That's correct.
So if I took the government's question to be, if Congress's purpose was to abrogate the accords, wouldn't the easy thing to have been to do rather than go through the way in which we have to go through several sections in order to get there, to simply say, as described in subsection A2A or A2B? B, because B is expressly you.
Yes. That might have been an easier way to do it, but that still begs the question of did they do it? And our position here is that they did so, and that they did so clearly. It's also, I think, relevant to that question, Judge Garland, that if you look at the history of how that section, the specific reference, and C3 wound up in the statute, there is some consistency and logic to it. The Senate version did not have that specific reference when this bill went to Congress, nor did it have C3. Both of those were added as part of the House version, and there's a considerable amount of harmony and coherence to both of them having been added for the purpose of...
Once you start down that road, aren't you causing some problems, though? Because wasn't there a specific language to address the accords expressly, and that was not rejected.
Not in this bill. Mm-hmm. Not in this bill. And I respectfully submit that under the canons, Judge Griffith, clearly language in failed legislation does not control the interpretation of language in this legislation. What the court has to do is look to the text in this bill, in this enactment. I had hoped to reserve 5 minutes, but I'm happy to answer more questions while I'm here if the court wishes.
Hearing no further questions, I can reserve the time. Thank you very much. Mr. Yellen?
May it please the court, I'm Louis Yellen. With me at council table is Douglas Letter. We're here today on behalf of the United States. Your Honors, the cost of obtaining the hostages' freedom was an agreement by the United States to bar litigation against Iran concerning the hostage taking. That price was not easily paid. It was a very difficult, exceedingly difficult foreign policy call. But having been made, that foreign policy call became the background legal rule that governs this litigation as it governed the plaintiff's prior litigation. Of course, a background rule of this sort can be abrogated by Congress, but this court requires a clear statement of Congress's intent precisely to abrogate. And the reason for that clear statement rule is because there are important separation of powers values that are being protected. Number one, a determination that Congress squarely considered that its action was going to require the United States to violate an international agreement, and number two, to give the President the notice that he needs of Congress's intent so that the President can decide whether or not to exercise his constitutional veto power. The clear statement that this Court has said is required in this case to provide these plaintiffs with a right to sue Iran does not exist in the NDAA. We know that
What was Congress trying to do if they weren't trying to give these folks a cause of action for the hostage taking? What was Congress trying to do?
Your Honor, I don't know that it makes sense in this context to say that Congress as an institution was trying to do anything. As Your Honor well knows, Congress is made up of multiple members with divergent interests. Legislation is a big compromise among the varying interests. There are clearly members of Congress who do want these plaintiffs to have a right to sue Iran. There are other members of Congress who do not. Members who wanted Iran to be able to be sued by these plaintiffs included language, I'm sure, of this sort in the hopes that this court would find that it was sufficient. But this court has explained what a clear statement would look like. It gave an example, not an exhaustive example, but an example of the clear statement. Members of Congress introduced legislation over the years that would have satisfied the court's requirement. Those pieces of legislation did not pass. And with all due respect to my opposing counsel, I think in this context, failed legislation is absolutely critical and absolutely relevant. In cases in which the courts, including this court, have said failed legislation is not indicative of Congress's intent, those aren't cases in which there was a back and forth of sort like this, where you have litigation.
As I understand Mr. Terwilliger's argument, your textual argument rests on the pending cases argument.
That's incorrect, Your Honor.
How so?
Plaintiffs would like the battle to be on that field. We believe, Your Honor, that regardless of the outcome of that question, that is, regardless of whether 1083C3 permits suit, whether an original case was pending or not, Congress did not give a clear statement. And the reason for that is, Plaintiffs here are relying on a general right of action that refers to a general jurisdictional provision that in turn refers to a general transition rule allowing plaintiffs with certain types of claims to bring suit. The only purpose of the transition rule was to eliminate a statute of limitations bar. So for the moment, let's put the transition rule to the side. Imagine that we just had the private right of action at issue here. Plaintiff's theory, I think, necessarily would be that this private right of action would be sufficient for them to bring suit. I think there's no doubt that this private right of action does not indicate Congress's intent to abrogate the Algiers Accords. If that's correct, then the fact that transition rules, which Congress enacted to permit certain plaintiffs to avoid a statute of limitations bar, whether or not it required a case to be pending, that is the original action to which the new action related, whether or not it required it to be pending, that's still a general statute.
If I follow that, is it clear, in your view, that the purpose of the private right of action was to overrule our opinion in Sosipio?
Is it clear? Yes, in the opinion in Sosipio, which held that there was no federal right of action.
There was no federal right of action, and that was against Iran, too, wasn't it? I don't remember.
I'm not entirely positive, Your Honor. I think it may have been, but I have to confess I don't recall.
It was a case against Iran, but it didn't arise out of the hostage taking.
Correct, Your Honor.
So the Algiers Accord had nothing to do with Sosipio, and one could reason that it had nothing to do with the overruling of Sosipio and the creation of a private right of action. Okay. Beyond that, the only other change dealt with, I'm parroting what you're saying, so I understand it, dealt with the statute of limitations question.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So that's it, as far as the alteration of the statute from our first decision to this case.
That's exactly right, Your Honor. There are some minor but non-substantive, in our view, modifications to the jurisdictional provision as well, but it parrots almost...
What do you make of there is an intervening event that's not an amendment of the statute, and that's the Fund for Animals case. What's your take on that?
Forgive me, Your Honor. The Fund for Animal case is not coming to mind. It's a title of a caption of a case that I'm familiar with, but
Kempthorne?
I'm not recalling.
Kempthorne? Where we said that the canon requiring clear statement only applies to ambiguous statutes?
Understood, Your Honor. Right. I'm sorry, Your Honor, but I think, as Your Honor asked in opposing counsel's colloquy with the court, the question is ambiguous as to what? And I think the question that the court has to ask is whether this statute unambiguously shows Congress's intent to abrogate the Algiers Accord or to necessarily create a private right of action for these plaintiffs. I don't think that the statute is unambiguous in that sense, or put another way.
What if the statute just said, in any case involving a country that is currently on the terrorist list, the plaintiff, whenever his or her cause of action arose, has a cause of action? Do you say that's not good enough?
I think it's not. I think if it was prefaced with notwithstanding any other law, it would be a closer case. Whether that satisfies...
If it is in direct contradiction to whatever the previous statute was, and even if it clearly would cover this case, you say it has to have a reference to the other. Can you cite
it? It doesn't have to have a reference to the other, Your Honor. It has to indicate, for example, that Congress clearly intended that these particular plaintiffs, either by identifying their claims of hostage taking by...
Now, you're saying it has to have a reference to this particular case. You're just being a little more vague about what that reference would be.
Well, I think that's important, Your Honor.
Is there a case that's ever said something like that? Any case that says that the lack of the notwithstanding language or the lack of a specific reference to a case made it not a clear enough statement?
Well, Your Honor, I think that your last opinion in this case
that
comes...
Give examples.
I understand, Your Honor.
I didn't say that was the only way.
And I think that's the problem, Your Honor, because I doubt that there is a case that addresses precisely that issue, because the question always is going to be whether the language at issue satisfies the clear statement requirement. Let me be very clear, Your Honor. We don't think there are magic words here. We think the...
It sounds like you do think there are magic words.
No, we don't, Your Honor. We gave multiple examples on pages 24 and 33 of our brief of types of statements by Congress that would be sufficient to abrogate the accords. There were multiple pieces of bills that were presented to Congress to consider that would have satisfied the requirement. Whether or not there's...
Mr. Whitaker characterized it as if it was created a cause of action that was repugnant to the accords, that would abrogate the accords. Do you disagree with that?
I think it would have to be a necessary conflict, not a possible conflict. And I think that shows the exact difference in the way the government and plaintiffs are seeing
that.
Help me
understand why this isn't a conflict.
There is, the question is not whether it's possible to construe the statute as providing a right of action. It creates a general right of action. Anytime a clear statement rule is required, a statute could be read to apply in the context in which the clear statement rule would apply. Consider extraterritoriality. A statute that doesn't expressly say that it will apply outside the jurisdiction of the United States could be read to apply outside.
You could take a statute that gives a general federal right of action. That doesn't mean, for example, that it abrogates sovereign immunity of the United States. I mean, that's your point.
That's exactly right, Your Honor. That's exactly right. The fact that there is a general...
Is there any cause of action that the hostages were given by Congress?
No, Your Honor.
None.
None whatsoever. Congress, if it wished to provide a cause of action for these plaintiffs, could have...
All Congress did was waive sovereign immunity for any by Iran for any claim that the hostages brought
would wish to present. That's exactly right, Your Honor. So in that sense, this case is no different than the case
time, right?
Than it was here before this court last time. That's our position.
Different tests than we would ordinarily apply to one statute overruling another or previous statute. Is that right?
Is it a different test? I don't think
yes,
it's.
Do you think it's the same?
Your Honor, I think it's the same where you have a clear statement requirement.
Well, I'm asking you, when do you apply a clear statement requirement and when don't you? If it's a question of a later in time statute, does the later in time statute have to say, notwithstanding any earlier in time statute, or is it enough if the later in time statute is simply flatly inconsistent?
I think it depends on the background of the subject that is being regulated by the statute, Your Honor. When you're dealing with a treaty or an executive agreement that creates a substantive rule of decision or a substantive rule in any case, if it's not a rule of decision, in a U.S. court, then I do think you require a clear statement rule. Just as in the extraterritoriality context or the question of extraterritoriality, the Supreme Court has said you need a clear statement.
You don't require that for inconsistencies with the Constitution of the United States. Why is that?
Your Honor, there are...
Why are treaties more important than the Constitution?
I'm maybe missing your question, Your Honor, because a statute can't overrule the Constitution of the United States.
Right. So for the constitutional avoidance canon,
yes,
we don't look at, it's not required that there be an express statement. As long as the statute can only be read one way on its face without reference to notwithstanding possible conflict with the Constitution. We have to read it that way and then decide the constitutional question. But here you're not asking that. Here you're asking us to avoid a possible conflict with a treaty, or in this case only an executive agreement, with a stricter rule.
I guess the question I would say is slightly different, Your Honor. We're not asking you to avoid a potential conflict. We're asking you whether or not Congress, which well knows the requirement of a clear statement in this context, has done what is required to indicate its intent to change the legal background in light of the critical separation of powers context in which this legislation is enacted. There are ramifications for the violation of an international agreement. If we violate this agreement, it could make it harder for the United States.
But in the end, there is no separation of powers question here, right? Because
I disagree, Your Honor.
Well, it's clear that Congress could expressly overrule the Algiers Accord. There's no doubt.
Only with the president's agreement not to veto the case, and only if Congress had a sufficient majority in that instance to override a veto. That hasn't happened, Your Honor. The separation of powers question here is whether Congress put the president on notice that it intended to put the United States in violation of its international agreement, which could make it harder for us if we're ever, God forbid, in the position of having to get hostages out in the future. It could make it significantly more dangerous and more difficult for us to affect that same outcome.
Consequence of this, of your argument that every plaintiff in other cases not involving the hostages has to be pending also?
Your Honor, in the brief before this court, we suggested that that was a possible interpretation of the statute. Our burden was not to establish definitively what the interpretation of 1083C3 is. We don't think this court needs to decide it, because even if it's decided...
Oh, well, that the very next case will be, does whatever rule we apply here apply in all cases? Or is your view, this is the Clark versus Martinez question, does this apply only to these plaintiffs, or does it apply to everyone with a terrorism case that wasn't pending at the time?
Your Honor, again, we don't think you need to decide the 1083C3 question, because even if it were decided in plaintiff's favor, you could say arguendo, even if it were decided in plaintiff's favor, there still is not a clear statement by Congress to abrogate the accords. You just have a general transition rule affecting the statute of limitations. This isn't Clark v. Martinez question. We're not suggesting one interpretation for one case and another interpretation for another. Our only point here, Your Honor, this Court has not definitively construed 1083C3.
It's a lot of words, but I'm not sure I'm understanding. The bottom line...
Sorry, that's my failure then.
No, I'm not sure about that. The bottom line question is, if we decide here that it has to be for a pending case, and therefore that it can't apply to them, for somebody who sues Iraq or who sues Iran in a different circumstance, not involving the hostage taking, and it's not a pending case, are they also out of luck?
It depends on the reach of your holding, Your Honor. If this court definitively construes 1083C3, then it will apply to any case seeking to invoke that provision. What I was trying, not clearly, I suppose, to suggest, Your Honor, is that the court need not reach and resolve that question. It's not essential to the decision in this case, so the court can reserve the precise question.
That's exactly what they tried to do in Zavidas, and the court later said, doesn't make any difference what they were reserving. There's only one way to interpret the statute. That is, once you've interpreted the statute, it has to apply to everybody.
Right. What I'm suggesting, Your Honor, is you don't need to interpret this provision. You could say, even assuming that plaintiffs are correct, that's not sufficient to show Congress's clear statement, clear intent to abrogate the Algiers Accords.
And why is it they could not have done that in Zedvitas?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I don't remember the case well enough to answer the question. I'd have to look at the case again to refresh my memory. I do recall the case, I do recall the issue, but I just don't think that in this case, I don't even recall that clear statement rule applied in Zedvitas.
Well, really exactly what the issue is. So, and it's very much like what Mr. Twilliger is raising here, which is whether the question is a lack of ambiguity rule or a clear statement rule.
This court has already said.
You're picking the clear statement rule.
This court has already picked the clear statement rule. I think that is binding precedent here, Your Honor. I think the court would have to go back on the Rader 1 decision if it wanted
what
to suggest.
What Randolph is asking you about in Fund for Animals has sounded, in that case, which came after Rader, it appeared to interpret Rader in a lack of ambiguity rather than a clear statement rule. That's the reason not being able to read Judge Randolph's mind, but nonetheless having a good idea of how he thinks.
Right.
My guess is that that's the reason he was asking you that question.
I now have put two and two together with your help, Your Honor, and I appreciate that. I guess I would go back to the original question that Judge Randolph asked opposing counsel, which is, what is the ambiguity? What is the question that is being answered? If the question is whether or not Congress has indicated its intent to abrogate the Algiers Accords or to provide these particular plaintiffs with a right of action, I think there is nothing in the statute to create any suggestion that Congress intended to do that by enacting a general statutory right of action, general transition rules, and a general jurisdictional provision. Okay. Thank you, Your Honors.
How much time does Mr. Twilliger have?
4 minutes. Thank you, Your Honor. It's a little troubling, I guess, to hear the government say that, and I realize this is de novo review, but to hear the government say that even if the plaintiffs are right about Section C3, that's still not enough, because I think that's clearly wrong as a matter of law. As Judge Kavanaugh observed in the Fund for Animals decision, quote, distorting statutory language simply to avoid conflicts with treaties would elevate treaties above statutes in contravention to the Constitution. What we're really talking about here, I think what this dialogue has been about, and I can appreciate how the court would struggle with this, is the application of a clear statement rule in the context of this particular case and this type of an issue. And I think if you look at the clear statement rule as it's been expressed in a variety of circumstances, it's pretty clear that there's not a rule per se. The extent of the rule or the extent of the clear statement required very much depends on the context of the ruling. And while I'm not going to stand here and lecture the court on other aspects of the clear statement rule, it clearly demands different kinds of clear statements in different contexts. But let's look at it in this context. And this context means the prior decisions of the Supreme Court and this court, which established that context. One of the things that's clear, as this court reminded us in South African Airways, is that so far as the Congress is concerned, if it passes a subsequent in time statute which is in conflict, direct conflict with a treaty, then the statute has to prevail. And the court reminded us that since Whitney versus Robinson in 1888, even if Congress does that by accident, not by design, if there is clear repugnancy, that's sufficient.
Yeah, but later cases, I agree with you about Whitney. I think you're right about that. But I think later cases, even though they continue to cite Whitney, they say something quite different. The Weinberger case, which you're familiar with, says something quite different. And one theme that seems to come out of these later cases, and correct me if you think I'm making a mistake here, is the theme that Congress has to speak to the precise question of abrogation. If it does, then you're quite right, the later statute controls. But if it doesn't, then we have all these statements from the court saying the silence on this question is not enough, the Congress must state affirmatively, et cetera, et cetera.
Your Honor, I don't necessarily disagree with your characterization of where the law has gone, and I think there is tension, as Judge Garland indicated, between application of a no ambiguity rule and a clear statement rule. I would suggest that the way that is resolved in this case and is resolved in our favor is really quite simple. The court first has to look at the statute that Congress passed, and it has to ask itself, is there an ambiguity in that statute? And if the answer to that is no, and the only ambiguity...
Ambiguity about what?
About whether or not we have a cause of action under that statute. If the answer to that is no, that we have a cause of action under that statute, and I submit it, there is no ambiguity about that. The government's wrong about C3. It's clear on its plain language. If there is no ambiguity, then that statute, an unambiguous statute, and that's the test, contravenes the treaty.
What do you do with cases or with a situation in which you have a general federal cause of action and a suit is brought under that general federal cause of action against the United States, and there's no clear indication that Congress intended to waive sovereign immunity?
I think sovereign immunity is a separate standard has been established in the cases for sovereign immunity than exists here.
The point I'm raising with you is, it does it follow if you have a cause of action? In the first go round in this case, I think we assumed that you had a cause of action, but it turned out it was a state law cause of action. But aside from that, is just because you have a cause of action, does that mean that that abrogates a treaty?
It does in the context of this case, yes. Because Congress providing us with a cause of action here, particularly with the specific reference in the jurisdictional section to this case, not only is the cause of action in repugnancy and therefore under the existing cases a clear statement in conflict with the treaty, but Congress went further and indicated the intent of what it was trying to accomplish by including the specific reference to this case.
It wouldn't for sovereign immunity of the United States, but it would for the Algiers Accord.
Well, Your Honor, I can't. The sovereign immunity cases seem to me, in terms of the jurisprudence that has developed, to be at least somewhat different. I think the important thing here is that, and I understand the importance of struggling with this, but the government's position, frankly, at least as we heard it today, would turn a clear statement rule into an express statement rule, and that's not necessary. It also, the government's position, would have this court rule that unless there is some kind of supermajority in Congress when it passes a later in time statute that's in conflict, that the separation of powers issue here, which has not been litigated in this case, to me really is frankly quite simple. It is the matter of the court respecting what Congress did. And here what the Congress has done is establish this cause of action. Unless the court can point, the government and the judge below can point to some affirmative ambiguity that defeats the finding that there is a cause of action, I think the cases are clear, Your Honor, that is in repugnancy to the treaty.
Yeah. I mean, one of the problems, the Gregory versus Ashcroft case, which we cited the first time around, says the purpose of the clear statement rule is to make sure that Congress faced this issue. And the issue here is abrogation of the Algiers Accord. And we struggle today back and forth and going through the statute. I mean, but your position is Congress did face it, and that a majority of the members of Congress who voted for this legislation knew that it was abrogating the Algiers Accord. And that's looking at the statute, it's hard to get that out.
Well, but that's not, respectfully, Your Honor, I don't think that is an accurate statement of the clear statement rule as applied to this in this context.
Well, you may be right, but the fact of the matter is that was the rationale that was used in our first opinion. So we have a stare decisis question here. I mean, that was the...
Well, but except that I don't think it's controlling. I disagree with government counsel about that. And while certainly Rader 1 may inform aspects of the decision here, and the court's treatment of the clear statement rule in Rader 1 certainly it needs to be fully considered in this context. But the context of that statute that was in effect then, 1605A7, and this statute are entirely different, because it's far more explicit, both in terms of the cause of action, the claims that are covered, and combined with the reference to these particular plaintiffs.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you to both sides. We'll take the case under submission. Could we have a brief recess?